Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the tailgate podcast. Nick, I've got my playoff beard. I'm sweaty after a workout. And this is what this weekend is all about. We recovered from our late season injury slash illness. It's playoff time. Let's go, baby.
Terry, people aren't giving you enough credit. I mean, that was the Jordan flu game that you had last week. And I think you even said that you were diagnosed with a terminal tummy ache and a bad case of the sniffles. So I'm glad to see that the recovery has been speedy. And just before we started recording, like, what a time for sports fans in general. The NFL draft, NHL playoffs, NBA playoffs, the NLL playoffs were popping off this weekend. College, conference tourneys are shaping up. If you're a sports fan, it doesn't get better than like the month of April. Coming off the Masters, doing all this great stuff. I kind of hit little various walls throughout the season, but ran through all of those, and we're in a spot where we can just sit back, talk lacrosse, be great friends, and have a great time.
It is an incredible precursor to what could be the hardest podcast we've ever recorded, because there is so much to get to on this penultimate weekend of the 2024 men's college lacrosse season. But real quick before we do, I just want to shout out Josh Byrne. 5 goals and an assist, overtime game-winning goal for the Bandits in their quarterfinal. Obviously, you called the game that went to overtime as well. So not to give Dane Doby short shrift, but oh my God, Josh Byrne is so goddamn good.
And the way that he was just cockily walking up, and he was just like, okay, this has kind of been a fun back and forth, but you guys had a good run. I'm going to go ahead and end it. Literally just walking as if he was, you know, casually taking a stroll down the street. 2 steps to his left, uncorks one. Bandit land explodes. The call was great. I mean, we've said it once before, but the crowds this year have been awesome. Not just in the numbers, but in the pops, the excitement, the engagement, the entertainment. It just makes it such a good product from all the way NLL, all the way to, I mean, I've seen some decent crowds at the Idaho State level, Terry.
There you go.
They're showing up for everybody.
Well, that's a good segue into talking about college lacrosse, because I'm pretty sure the biggest crowd of the weekend was in Charlottesville, 6,497 fans to watch the Notre Dame Fighting Irish dispatch of the Cavaliers. We're not really going to talk about this game, but it was important, and obviously you went to Notre Dame, so I didn't want to let it go unmentioned. You got anything on this one real quick, though?
Yeah, and just going into this episode, we are going to essentially breeze through games at a much quicker pace. If you're looking for in-depth, Venmo me and Terry $500 each, and we can provide that to you. But it's more about conference tournament seeding, so we'll breeze through these games. It's inevitable where we start, and it's Notre Dame. If you don't like it, somebody beat them. So, you know, that's been very, very difficult for everybody to do. Outside of that, we are Georgetown loss.
Shout out to Kavanaugh. It would be helpful if Virginia decided not to beat themselves in the second half by being completely unable to clear the ball, but that doesn't mean that Ohio State didn't do a few good things, and you're about to talk about them.
Yep. Pat Kavanaugh set the points record. I have this great running bit. I texted Matt where I'm like, the nepotism is disgusting. just because your brothers were good, you have to be good? Like, that's bullshit. I thought it was very funny. Notre Dame actually showed ridiculous fight, and the only thing that I used the term ridiculous there is because it would have been very easy for them to just say, hey, our eyes are on the ACC tourney. Let's not get hurt. We don't really care about this game. It would be easy to kind of fall into that mindset, but they didn't. They were down 7-4. They had a chance to coast into the ACCs, but they scored the next 4 to retake the lead. UVA retook it 9-8 with Cormier on men up goal and Colsey being good at lacrosse. But Notre Dame had the last 3. The stat that stuck out to me the most, 50-26 ground balls, which again, Virginia kind of kept shooting themselves in the foot on the clear. But there were a couple of those, hey, cue up yakety sacks during this ground ball scrum. And it just kind of was those 30-35 second, I don't even know what's going on. Everybody's just out there playing. The 2 things that I really like is Virginia, we've talked how athletic they are. There were 2 moments, and it was Faison just saying, hey, I'm more athletic than my guy, and I'm going to go score. Good luck. And he did that. And then we talked about the role that Eric Dobson has on Notre Dame. His right-handed pass as he was dodging down the opposite alley across his body with his offhand. I think it was either to Jake Taylor or Pat Kavanaugh. I can't remember. That is absolutely lethal. Going to pay off dividends. Terry, Notre Dame, UVA.
Yeah, just real quick. I think there are some folks that are asking what's wrong with UVA. And my answer is they lost to Duke because they always lose to Duke. Just throw that game out. They lost by a goal in the Carrier Dome in what was one of the games of the year in one of the incredibly emotionally charged environments of the season. And then you just explained that Notre Dame beat them and took it from them. And so now, you know, they've got four losses on the year, three losses in a row. I think what's wrong with Virginia is that maybe the preseason expectations were that they were very solidly two or three, or maybe one, but probably two or three. Now I think they're just very solidly 4-5. And the biggest thing that's happened to the we're going to talk about what's wrong with Duke here in a second. The biggest thing that's happened is that top three now I think very, very clearly has had Johns Hopkins injected into, you know, that upper tier. And from an NCAA tournament resume standpoint, Denver and Syracuse as well. So, you know, really all that's happened is that the top three has turned into a top six. I don't think that there's something wrong with them. I just think that the other teams are a little bit better than maybe the preseason conventional wisdom suggested.
Yeah, very well put. And then also shout out Kastner. He's going to be going to play basketball at Stanford. Love seeing, you know, to play two sports in college. I mean, you got to be a stud. So good for him. Okay, so nothing wrong with UVA. Everybody relax. Sick crowd in Charlottesville. And shout out to Coach Corrigan's 94-year-old mother being in attendance at that game. That is really cool. And in, you know, only thought on that, it's the story that just kind of transcends sports. And I loved his comments after the game where he was like, you know, how lucky am I that I not only have a mother that's 94, but that she's able to attend the game. I don't care who you are. It should bring a tear to your eye. Awesome stuff. The more important game for the ACC was UNC Duke. And the one word that described this game for me was, what? Like, what are we doing? So we'll briefly talk about the game. But UNC was up 9, extremely relevant later. But Duke ended the game with a 6-goal run. Petromala scored 4. McGovern had 3. Petro set the freshman goal record, blah, blah, blah. The relevance in that score was that if UNC won by 5 or more goals, which they did not, the final score was 15-12. They did not win by 5 or more goals. If they did, they would have clinched a spot in the ACC tournament. And it seemed like they, quite frankly, didn't play for that goal differential win, to the point where McGovern in the postgame interview even said, no, it wasn't talked about. What? So really the talking point for me here was, if you're up 9 and every player on the field knows that you need to have that 5 goal differential, you keep your foot on the gas like your literal season depends on it, because that is not hyperbolic in any way.
Or you put your foot on the brake and make sure that every possession lasts 80 seconds and you try to just make sure that Duke only scores 4 instead of scoring 6.
And so it goes to me where it's like, Bresci, what are we doing here? And, you know, not, it's certainly players are players and they'll make mistakes, but you have to, as a coach, manage that situation way better than what you did. So the talking point for me here is, how critical are we going to be of Bresci? And I'm at about the 8 out of 10. That's inexcusable. Like, you have to answer to that, and you need to probably have, you know, a pretty damn good explanation to the AD. Because if I'm looking at that, I'm going, what are we doing? Terry, how critical are you of Bresci in that late game management?
I don't know. And I want you to help me figure this out, because the simple fact is I can slice this like 7 different ways. And let's start like kind of the longest to go and maybe broadest, and then we can get like the most narrow, because there's so many different ways to chop this up. So the first is that Joe Bresci is in the first year. He just concluded the first year of a 3-year extension that he got last May. That's important, okay? And it included changing his staff, completely overhauling his staff. The second consideration is that Quint talked about this a lot on the broadcast, and you and I have talked about it a lot on prior podcasts, that their scheduling choices were very strange. They played Penn and Princeton in one weekend. They split those two games. Aside from that, they didn't really play a team that was in that 15 to 30 RPI range where you could potentially stack a couple of like back end of the top 20 quality wins, and that could help bolster your resume. But also it gives you a real indication of how good you exactly are. This is probably the 10th time I've said this so far this year. This Carolina team, and I felt this way dating all the way back to September, reminds me a lot of Syracuse last year. And what that meant was I had a feeling they were going to be in a position to play themselves in to the NCAA tournament very late in the season. And truthfully, that kind of, you know, there have been, you know, Carolina teams each of the last, not last year, but 2 years ago that fell into a similar bucket as well. So that's the first consideration. The second consideration, or, you know, the third, I guess, is that I don't know how clear anybody knew what the tiebreaker criteria actually was in terms of the way that it was communicated from the league office to the teams themselves and also to ESPN. If you watched this game in real time, it was clear that they were working out a combination of the goal differential scenarios and the multi-team tiebreakers such that they actually refined. I'll put it this way. There were points during the Duke-Carolina game where they laid out a scenario in which Virginia was not going to be included, depending on the outcome of the Notre Dame-Virginia game. That ultimately did not prove to be an available outcome. Virginia was in regardless. So point being that there was confusion kind of broadly around what the criteria actually was and kind of what it meant. With respect to how Carolina was playing this, in terms of trying to extend their season, there's been some weird suggestions that I don't really want to support, but I find it impossible not to at least raise the prospect of them on social media about, did they not want their season to end? Did they not want to make it to the ACC tournament? Did they want their season to end? Was concluding their season with a regular season victory over Duke the best case scenario for how this whole thing was going to play out? The reason I don't even want to entertain that is because in 2016, this team came back from, I believe, a 7-goal deficit in the fourth quarter of their final regular season game. If they had lost, they would not have been eligible for NCAA tournament selection. They end up going on to win the national championship that year, despite also coming back a fourth quarter deficit in their first round game on the road against Marquette. Joe Brushy knows as well as pretty much any coach in college lacrosse that it is not over until it's over. So I just struggle to think that maybe they didn't want to go to the ACC tournament and give themselves an opportunity to play themselves into the NCAA tournament. So there's actually one layer that's like a little bit kind of like intermediary between, which is that right now they are eligible for NCAA tournament selection. They are 7-7. Had they made the ACC tournament and lost and been 7-8, lost in the semifinals, they would not have been eligible for NCAA tournament selection. Now, are they likely to be included? No. In beating Duke, their RPI went from 27th, which is not even in consideration, to 20th, which usually you don't get all the way down to 20 in terms of where you're considering teams from an RPI standpoint. That being said, so I kind of coincide the when I started really doing the bracket analysis with when this. So the criteria has evolved since it expanded to a 16-team tournament, but it's really been in a relatively static place since right around the time that I started doing bracketology, which let's call it like, you know, 2012, 2013, somewhere in that range. I can't remember specifically. But in that window of time, I did this for a bracketology piece. I believe it was the year that Jacksonville got left out. I went through and isolated the lowest RPI-rated team or ranked team to get in every year. Nick, do you want to hazard a guess as to which was the lowest RPI team to get in to the NCAA tournament in the last 10 years, 10 plus years?
I don't know. UNC in 2016?
UNC in 2016. They were number 18.
No way.
So the point is that maybe the thought was, all right, we had a top five win at Duke to our resume, and we'll see how the combination of Virginia, Duke, Syracuse, and Notre Dame playing each other kind of lifts our RPI. We don't risk being ineligible because they would obviously, you know, they'd have to win their semifinal game. If they had won the semifinal, lost the championship, they'd have been 8-8. If they'd won both, they would have been 9-7. Obviously, would have added quality wins. That would have been a good scenario, except for the fact that, like, you don't know. So those are all, like, the potential conspiracy theory criteria. Let's just get down to the game itself. So you're up 3. You've had Duke go on this 6-goal run. You've got the ball with about 90 seconds left, and you put the brakes on. That was when people started paying attention and really questioning or scratching their head about whether or not they should be going for it, because Duke was doubling. The goal was open. Like, they could have gone and scored and gotten it to 4, and Brady Wambach had a tremendous game, so the likelihood that you win the faceoff and give yourself an opportunity to stretch it back out to 5 was an available outcome. So that's the consideration matrix. Like, help me distill this. I don't know how critical to be. I don't know what level of blame to put on it.
Yeah, so, I mean...
Also, they're in tremendously injured. Like, tons and tons of injuries.
Which, that sucks. Hope everybody gets better. But the thing that I think most people, especially in the ACC, learned is do not leave it up for, like, you know, take all doubt. Don't... It's a broader sense of control what you can control. Don't let the refs dictate the outcome of the game or blame the refs. Don't let us put ourselves in a position where now we're rallying the troops against Donna. Like, that is not a good position to be in. And every player, and I would assume Bresci would be the same, where it's like, UNC's a good team. I wouldn't be surprised if, like, you know, there were a couple ACC teams that were like, okay, you know, we might be more comfortable playing Duke as opposed to UNC. Like, there's just some weird matchup stuff. And as we learned in 2016, UNC can go on a run. And even though the rosters are different, UNC still has that aura around their program. That they anything can happen at any time, especially this season. It's just been nuts. So, I mean, I'll even just put my foot in the ground and say that is absolutely not the case. You know, especially from a player perspective, like, you need to be hungry. You are hungry. You want to make the ACC tournament. You want to make a run. You want to prove to everybody heading into the postseason, if you win the ACC tournament to secure your spot, you have all the momentum in the world and you got life by the balls. Like, so the head scratching, you know, it, I don't think there was any 4D galaxy brain chess. You know, the 8 out of 10, I can attribute to a little confusion on what the exact scenario was. What I will not concede is just the idea that they were trying to play 4D chess with a quality win and leaving it up to the committee in the end.
Hold on. Let me give you one additional point of evidence.
Hit me.
There are two coaches on the committee. You want to know who one of them is?
Joe Bresci.
Indeed.
Ooh, Terry. Are you uncovering a little? Is this journalist?
I'm just laying out facts. I'm just laying out facts.
Follow the money, and it leads right back to Washington, D.C. and Chapel Hill. I mean, listen, let's put a pause and say that if UNC gets the bid with the 20, well, there will be some fluctuations.
Yeah.
If they get in, let's go to the store, let's buy aluminum foil, let's craft it into a hat, and let's start flinging conspiracy theories out there and eventually wind up with the triple bald podcast on Joe Rogan explaining how corrupt the NCAA is.
Love it. Nick, what's up with Duke?
Oh, my God. I have no idea. And it scares me because historically I'm like, yeah, anytime you think Duke sucks, they're about to go on a massive run. But that's good in February. I have not been really impressed with their game. I mean, yeah, they make some ridiculous plays. They have talent all over the field. And I just keep going back to this idea of, like, what is missing? And it seems a little bit like they're playing shit show ball, where they're kind of standing around and watching somebody do something without any structure or movement. And I feel like this is a broader sense when I watch lacrosse, is like, what are the off-ball players doing at the moment of a good dodge? And I haven't found any consistency with Duke in that. They'll have a good dodge, and if there's a reasonable slide and recovery, like, they're kind of shit out of luck. There's no, you know, consistent backside exchanges, and I just look at their offense first. Their defense, I don't even know. So I haven't watched enough Duke film. I'd have to go back and watch their last 3 or 4 games in completion. I've only watched a quarter or two of each of those. But to me, it just kind of seems like that magic that you see happen with really good teams is missing. And it starts with off-ball movement on offense and consistent communication. Like, what is the pillar of Duke's defense? Are they a slide and recover? Are they a, we can just beat you one-on-one? What are their pillars of their offense and defense? And it seems like those pillars are trying to change game over game, which at this point in the season, red flag, be-do, SOS.
Yeah, it's a really interesting kind of situation because if you remember in March, they had, what, 6 games in 18 days or whatever it was? And they will have only played 3 games between March 27th and May 3rd when they end up taking on Syracuse, a team they lost to during that 6-game stretch and only put up 4 goals in the Carrier Dome. So typically the ACC tournament, just it's kind of like the Big Ten quarterfinals. We're not going to talk about them today because they're not that interesting. kind of feel that way about the ACC tournament, especially in seasons when all four teams are going to make the NCAA tournament. I'm really interested to see what Duke looks like against Syracuse.
That's going to be the story of the ACC tournament. And by the way, just side rant, how dumb is it to claim the regular season championship when you're going into a conference championship? I don't know why that bugs me as much as it does, but it's like, we won the regular season title, and it's like, and yeah, you could lose in the quarterfinals or the semifinals of your own conference tournament. It's the dumbest thing. I hate it. We got like regular season ACC championship rings in 2015, and I was like, what are these? Like, so do we just throw it? Like, how much can I get this at the pawn shop? Like, who cares? So that's just a side rant. But regarding the ACCs, I think it's got to be all eyes on Duke and how scary they're going to be and what kind of team they're bringing in May.
How hard is Corgan going to try to lose in the semifinals?
I hope so bad. I'm hoping so bad for Notre Dame loss just to give us a little juice. But again, like, I look at that Virginia game and I'm like, well, you did crawl out of a pretty significant hole there. Like, that's representative of the kick in the ass that you could use. With a loss, you can kind of parlay that momentum from a loss into, all right, well, we had a great comeback victory. So don't think that your season is safe. We've been down big, but we know how to claw our way out. So I'm truly gaslighting myself over here with, like, do I want them to lose? Do I want them to have a comeback? Do I want them to coast? Really fun stuff.
All right, Nick, the only thing you like talking about more than Notre Dame is yourself. So, holy shit, were you at the epicenter of the drama over the course of the last week? Because we recorded this early last Sunday morning, so that you could get to the Merrimack-Albany game, where an incident occurred during the game that led to a skirmish that you talked about on Twitter in real time. Come to find out, it was the result of a racial slur from a Merrimack posed to a UAlbany player. Both parties issued statements in the wake of the incident. There was a lot of conversation throughout the course of the week about how, you know, any further adjudication might end up unfolding. The Merrimack player was kicked off the team. There were questions about whether or not they were going to end up playing this weekend, and play they did. They beat Bryant 16-14, and in so doing, knocked Bryant out of the America East tournament as the defending champions. They won and won the AQ and went down to Hopkins for the first round of the NCAA tournament in 2023. They put themselves in a position to, if UAlbany won on Saturday night against Binghamton, set themselves up for a rematch in the America East semifinals against the Great Danes. Meanwhile, if Binghamton beat Albany, Binghamton ended up hosting. They were the number one seed and hosted the America East tournament. And if you haven't seen the news, the Great Danes topped the Bearcats 18-10, which means that Binghamton went from being able to host if they won to being out of the America East tournament. All of that is insane. You know what's more insane? The news that came out at about 4 or 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon that Mike Morgan had resigned from the program. So now the Merrimack Warriors get into the America East tournament. They have a rematch against a team that they just had a scuffle with 7 days prior. It'll have been 15 days or 13 days by the time the game occurs. They're going into it without their coach. It's the first time the program has made it to the postseason as a Division I program. I mean, you're close to this, so be a journalist and unpack this for me. Absolute insanity.
Oh my God, Terry. I mean, this was, I mean, the true unfortunate part is, I think it comes down to the Mike Morgan aspect, because, you know, I will not use the kids are kids excuse in this case, because, you know, I heard what was said. I'm not going to repeat it, but that's a statement that, like, you know, as I was talking and essentially just fielding questions from all of the parents after the game, they were like, yeah, you know what, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, hey, if what was said was what was said, like, let's hope that this doesn't make USA Today. And let's just hope that there's some internal shuffling. Like, the best case scenario is player dismissal, coach is exactly what happened. So, like, I don't want to call it the best case scenario, but I also saw a way in which this could have made national news. So, I will say what was interesting was how quickly and swiftly the AD handled the situation. He was ripping the team, you know, after the game and this and that. So it was addressed immediately. And I would like to give a shout out to Scott Marr. I had a chance to catch up with him after the game. We briefly talked about it, but we were kind of just catching up about life and you know, joking about the games that we played against them in years past. And if I had to, you know, describe that conversation, he just kind of seemed exhausted. He just seemed tired of this because, you know, if you think about native players playing in, you know, Division One, your mind immediately goes to Albany with the Thompsons. And, you know, there's a good history there. And he just kind of seemed exhausted and fed up. And, you know, he wasn't mad. He wasn't, you know, calling for anybody's head. He just goes, how can we move forward? Like, I'm kind of sick of this. Let's just go on. We're going to focus on ourselves. So huge credit to Scott Marr for just being a good leader of men. And I think in situations like this, the team kind of feeds off the energy of the coach. And it wasn't, let's go kill everybody. It was, let's just, you know, this is exhausting. It will be addressed. We'll go through the correct process. Now, what's interesting about this too is being relatively close to the program. It's just a bummer regarding Mike Morgan because, you know, again, I'm not going to use the kids are kids, but when the coach is held accountable for the players' actions, that needs to happen. But at the end of the day, you really don't have the entire control over what comes out of your players' mouths. So a guy who has been a part of Merrimack so well, talking to a couple of the players, you know, throughout the course of this week, it's just a bummer because the phrase that was said to me was no one can sell Merrimack like Mike Moore or like Morgan. Morgan is Merrimack. Merrimack is Morgan. So the fact that he you know, had to resign and everything like that, it ends an unbelievable run and a program that he built up into relevance with them clinching the first playoff berth. So I don't have a lot of takes. I'm not going to really get too much into the nitty-gritty because even as I was talking to the parents and some of the players, they were like, yeah, like what's going to happen? And I was like, the number one thing all of us can do right now is shut up, is keep your mouth shut. Don't take the social media. Keep it in the locker room. Boys, focus on yourself and focus on what's probably going to be headhunting fest come their rematch with Albany. The player has since been dismissed. Morgan has resigned. And, you know, I'm going to keep my mouth shut in the same advice that I was giving them. But I'll tell you what, the stands were getting a little hot too. The parents yelling at each other, you know, and whenever you see something like that happen off ball, you know, I was kind of saying, yeah. But in the back of my mind, I was like, oh no, like those off ball fights between attackmen and defensemen don't happen for no reason. So terrible comment. You know, my heart goes out to all the innocent people that were affected by this. You know, first and foremost, the players and players specifically for UAlbany and their program. And then the ricochet shots that'll affect all the players for Merrimack that are great kids. I've gotten to know a lot of them, phenomenal people. So that's really all I have to say about that. It's not going to be going much further. And I don't know, I've been to two college lacrosse games in the last 5 years and I'm batting 50% on Scandalgate. So maybe I just don't go to college lacrosse games, Terry.
Or maybe we just need to get you to more.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know if we want more scandals or I don't know if we want the denominator to come down. So as a result, you your batting average is a little bit more acceptable.
Matt Kavanaugh and I were talking about if Notre Dame makes it back, people were rumbling if I was even a fan because I didn't make it to the Natty last year. So maybe I'll get boots on the ground in Philly if that happens.
Well, then you'll be the scandal.
No better place, yeah, because, you know, what happened? Oh, Nick broke 15 tables and shattered his collarbone in excitement for the tailgate. But let's not forget what a disaster the America East is. Binghamton, UAlbany, Bryant. I mean, Merrimack objectively played a phenomenal game against Bryant to keep their season alive. And the rumblings that I've heard is like, we're going to be dealing with a lot of outside shit. Let's do this for us. Let's have a good send-off for Morgan. And, you know, let's finish the season right and do it the right way. So credit to the current players and captains and seniors on Merrimack for saying, this is a shitty situation. It's been addressed. We're cutting ties and we're moving forward.
And just to loop on that, Vermont beat UMBC 15-13 yesterday. That is the other semifinal. So they rematch each other on Thursday as part of the America East tournament in Albany, which is crazy. It's the first time it's in Albany since 2018.
Yeah. So moving on, and we've started this cast hot with ACC and America East talk. Let's cool it down with the most boring conference, potentially. Well, I guess it's between the Big Ten and the Ivy League. Princeton, Yale, and Cornell Penn is going to be the first two matchups. The drama was very underwhelming, quite frankly, because of Princeton. They dismantled Yale 15-8. And what had to happen, I believe, was Yale winning and Brown winning would have sent a not good record. I think they're what, 2-10?
They're 3-11 now. So yeah,
they were three and ten.
They would have been 4-10 going into the Ivy League tournament had they beaten Harvard. Yeah,
which would have been an incredible situation. But I mean, really, let's just call it out. Princeton, I mean, the performance of the year from them. Their defense played remarkably well. Colin Molshine is good at lacrosse. That's a hot take. And I actually have a question for you, Terry, because as we go back and forth in preparation for this, you said Yale is a MASH unit.
Yeah.
Now, I know that MASH is an old TV show, but for the younger listeners and even myself, what does that mean?
Well, so MASH was an old TV show. It was about, like, basically a field hospital during the Korean War. And so it was, like all the characters were, like, the doctors and nurses and stuff like that. So, yeah, I don't know what MASH stands for. I probably should. But it effectively means a Army field hospital. It means that they have a lot of injuries.
Mobile Army Surgical Hospital.
There you go.
And I just knew that off the top of my head. Anything about Princeton's performance?
Yeah, I think so. For me, this was a really interesting game. I picked Yale. My picks flipped back this week. I went 1-4.
Tough go.
And it was crazy too because, like, you know, I'm such an ardent believer in kind of the gotcha, right? Like, meaning like this team's got that team, and that is why I picked Virginia over Notre Dame. That felt really good through like the majority of the game. I should have used that motivation or that thought process to pick Carolina over Duke as well. Even though they haven't had the outsized, you know, Carolina hasn't, so to speak, had Duke's number recently. Like, I do think that, you know, the Carolina outplays a little bit what the expected result should be when they play Duke. In this instance, I should have picked Princeton just because Princeton was playing for their lives. And Yale had to be feeling pretty good about themselves getting through that five games in 13 days stretch unscathed. And they had won seven in a row, and they were taking the batting donut off. They hadn't played a team of Princeton's caliber in more than a month. So, well, with the exception of potentially BU, depending on how you feel about that. And really, so that was kind of the conditions going into the game. And you know, it was one of those things where as soon as the game started, so Nick Ramsey, who hadn't played since Dartmouth, took the opening faceoff, got, I think, like a little bit of contact from behind, and you could kind of see his knee buckle a little bit, and came off the field after the opening faceoff and threw his stick down in disgust. And it just felt similar but not as dramatic to in the first round of the 2016 NCAA tournament, Michael McCormick, who in the early part of the season was in contention for like a Schmeisser Award Defensive Player of the Year type situation for Yale, tore his ACL, I believe, like right around St. Patrick's Day, and then tried to pull the Luke Dupree and play on the torn ACL as a senior, and actually played like a decent percentage of that game. I believe it was against Navy. And you know, just couldn't finish it out. I think maybe he was partially tore and fully tore or whatever. And after that, like, the win completely came out of Yale's sails. And it was a big factor in why they lost that game. And so, not to say that was, I don't think it had as much of an emotional impact on the team in large, but Anthony Nunziata, who's their third string faceoff guy, they're still waiting for Machado Rodriguez to get back, who by the way, is leading the country in faceoff win percentage. And Nunziata gets hurt. He's playing hurt. They have to send a long pull out for three faceoffs. And so the possession advantage is very much tilted in Princeton's way, in their favor. They scored 15 goals. You know, they were at, I think, 37% efficiency. What was interesting to me was how effective they were offensively without really getting the days out of Colin Burns and Nate Kabiri that you might have expected them in order to get to 15 goals. So that's a little bit of something to watch for Princeton going forward in terms of have those guys hit a freshman wall? And, you know, if so, what does it mean relative to the complementary scoring that they're going to need out of the likes of, it was John Dunphy and Tucker Wade on Saturday. Certainly Chad Palumbo had a couple of big goals. So it's not as if they lack for it, but relative to what they were at the beginning of the season, I think that's something to keep an eye on. You know, at the other end of the field, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. You know, they're extremely efficient defensively. Princeton has been a team that I've wanted to write an article about their defense for 3 or 4 weeks, because through a meaningful part of the season, they were the number two most efficient defense in our ratings. And, you know, it reminded me of last year when North Carolina was number one through the first three quarters of the season. They ended up finishing number two, I believe, behind Notre Dame, who is number one in defensive efficiency right now as well. And the whole time, you're just like, how is Carolina doing this? It doesn't feel like they're playing this well. I wouldn't say that that was the case for Princeton. I didn't come away from watching them saying, like, how are they the number one or number two defense? But at the same time, I am interested in how are they the number one or number two defense mechanically. Like, you know, this is a team that graduated a few pieces from last year. Obviously, we've talked a ton about Mike Gianfricaro. Michael Bath is one of the better possession enders in terms of his cause turnover and ground ball numbers that not a lot of people know about. He's a new starter. Cooper Kissler is another new starter. So who's that? You know, how well is Colin Mulshine playing now when you stack up some of the matchups that he's had against the likes of CJ Kirst and now Matt Brandon, holding him to 2-1, far below his season average. That is impressive. And then they've had some injuries in their short 60 midfields and you know, have had some guys really step up in impressive ways. Liam Fairback is one guy that stands out to me there. And then Pace Billings at the long stick midfield is one of the best. So basically, I just wanted to talk to Matt Madelon and Jeremy Hirsch, get their perspective on why they were good. And I think this game was an excellent illustration of why they were good. The reason I didn't write that article is because they had a terrible game against Brown and then dropped to like 5 or 6. And so, you know, needed a little bit of time in order to separate that and then kind of dive back in. So that's on the agenda for this week. And I think that was, it was a really good example of, you know, a combination of a bunch of factors, because I think if you look at it from the Yale standpoint, you know, they started to press once they realized that they weren't going to get the ball. You know, they finished, I think they had 8 goals on 28 possessions, and that possession disadvantage and the way in which it manifested in the time of possession too, you could tell, like, they were really pressing. And so I think that there was just a lot that was tied back up into it. But in the same way that Vermont UMBC are immediately rematching each other, in the same way that we saw in the Big Ten with Michigan, Ohio State, and Rutgers, Penn State, we're going to see it in the Ivy League tournament, the Ivy League semifinals as well, as Princeton and Yale are going to be one of the semifinals. And like you said, Cornell Penn is going to be the other one.
And this is an interesting one. Who do you think has the advantage, the team that won or the team that lost heading into a rematch?
If there is any type of – if they're within like a certain margin of even with each other, meaning it's not like a total it's not like totally, you know, disparate matchup, I always favor the team that lost for two very clear and obvious reasons. The first is that the team that won has an incentive to run back exactly what they did, which makes them predictable. The team that lost has the incentive to change things up, which makes them unpredictable. And I think that for both of those reasons, it becomes a game plan advantage for the team that lost. And then when you add on top of that the motivation, which is that human nature is, if you beat somebody, you know you can beat them. And the confidence has benefits, but the complacency, I think, outweighs the benefit of the confidence. Whereas if you lost, then you're going to play with urgency and a little bit of healthy fear. You know you can lose to these guys. That means that you cannot take anything for granted. And if you're evenly matched up, the game is going to be won on the margins, and the margins are typically dictated by the team that is playing with more urgency and more desperation.
Very, very similarly, we'll mirror that. And also, like, I feel like sometimes I speak on behalf of, like, a player's mindset.
I agree, and I think that is what we want from you on this podcast.
Well, but sometimes it's like more niche, where I'm like, that was probably just me, and it probably wasn't relatable for a decent amount. I think this,
you mean,
is
not everybody is
unanimous.
6'2", 220, and running like a 4'5", and playing two sports in Notre Dame? That
and
kind
handsome.
Of relatable?
And humble.
No, not handsome. Speak to the follicle, the follically challenged of our listenership.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, if you start going bald in college and you get a sunburn on the top of your head in college while you have hair, DM me. I'll walk you through the entire process. But it was always nice. And for everything that you just stated, even before we really understood the dynamics of that, we only played back-to-back games, I think, like once or twice in my 4 years. But going into the game, having lost to them the previous week, there was just this sense across the entire team of like, oh, nice, now we get to win one. Like, now it's our turn to win. So it almost trickles down where it's like, yes, it's the preparation. Yes, it's the playing with the urgency. But there's almost this calmness of like, oh, nice, now we know what we got to do. Okay, let's just go make those adjustments. So I feel like you approached it from a very, you know, good analytical point. And then the idiot brain player oftentimes is just like, oh, nice, now it's our turn to win. Like, all of the smart, concise points can be distilled into a very stupid college lacrosse player's head of, cool, we lost, now we get to beat them. And it's why every time we beat Duke in the regular season, in the back of our minds,
like, oh, no.
Like, okay, let's hope they're on the other side of the bracket, and let's hope somebody snuffs them out. So we'll take a break from the boringness of the Ivy League.
Only boring because it could have been really exciting.
It could have been so sick. So, yeah.
Sorry, Larkin. That would have been cool. Yeah.
Yep, would have been so cool. It would have been really fun to watch you. But now, so I one day, like, there's we're in that group chat, and people will announce, like, life moves. Like Eddie Glazner retires, right?
Yeah.
Great career. The group chat's blowing up with, like, you know, prove that you didn't have to be an athlete or good-looking to play defense. You did unimaginable good things for the game. Funny stuff. In the middle of all of his banter, Larkin goes, guys, I like what Brown's putting out on film this week. He's just so laser-focused on Brown. He's like, oh, yeah, and by the way, congrats, Eddie. Guys, Brown, I think we're going to have a good weekend. Just like, holy... Dude, relax. But that's why we love him. So, yes, maybe not boring, but underwhelming. But let's go to the Electric Factory, the Patriot League. My goodness. The rundown of the scores. Boston was down 10-2 and came back to beat Colgate. And Colgate is a team that is structured with the kind of chaos. They thrive in the chaos. Well, Boston delivered a taste of their own medicine. And unbelievable comeback from them. Bucknell took Navy to overtime before falling 13-12. So Navy gets the overtime win after a goal was waved off with 5 seconds left that would have got them the victory. Army and Loyola, heavyweight tilt, blows back and forth. Army wins 13-11 to clinch the number one seed. But quite frankly, Loyola deserved to lose because they played zone. And the Patriot League is inarguably America's league for a number of different reasons. But for this weekend and for how this season has gone, my goodness, is it just because everything has gone in a way that is so enjoyable as a fan, so fun to watch. Even if you're just keeping up on scores and looking at records and seedings, I mean, the tangible energy coming from a box score and looking at the rankings, it flies off the screen.
Well, and I mean, we'd be remiss not to talk about just how electric these fan bases are on Twitter. I mean, the Army folks are like really like smart and passionate, and we can appreciate what they bring to the table. The Boston U fans are just like the most stereotypical Boston fans. And it's like, it was funny because obviously they lost a couple of humbling games to Lafayette and Lehigh, and you didn't hear much from them. And then they fell behind by 8 goals to Colgate. They come back and win, and all of a sudden it's like, you there was never a doubt. All you haters and losers can suck it. And I'm just like, oh, thank God I missed this so badly. It was awesome. So, yeah, I mean, here we are. Very clearly the Terriers did not want to have to go back to Hamilton on Tuesday, and so they get to bring the toothpaste to the harbor, and you know, we'll see what the rematch looks like there. And then Loyola heads down to Annapolis to take on the Midshipmen in the quarterfinals on Tuesday. You know, it's crazy because for all of the different permutations, and I think there were 16 of them, the variety, because there was all six teams were in, right? There was a comparative lack of drama in that way on Friday night. We knew who the six teams were. I'm pretty confident that every team could have finished in at least four different positions, and every team that was in a position to finish one or two also could have finished 3, 4, 5, or 6. So, like, the stakes were pretty wild. And not only that, but also, you know, the Patriot League tournament, it's not, you know, the AC1 tournament, all played at a neutral site. And so, you know, the it's a 6-team tournament, which means that the top two teams get buys to the semifinals. That's super valuable. Not as valuable when you're playing at a neutral site to be the 3 or 4 seed and have to, like, or get the opportunity to wear your home jersey in the quarterfinal. Whereas if you're hosting on Tuesday and you don't have to, like, travel 400 miles in order to play a quarterfinal game and then go to Army and then, you know, have to play a team that is on a week's rest when you're on 2 or 3 days rest, like, that's a huge advantage. And so, yeah, there's a lot to it. So I covered the Army Loyola game, and that was really interesting because the story of the game was always going to be around faceoffs and possession, because Loyola has really struggled facing off basically since Bailey Savio graduated, but certainly throughout this season. And then Will Colletti, who is, you know, in the mix with, we already mentioned Machado Rodriguez, but Jake Naso and some of these other guys for first team All-American, he didn't play against Bucknell because he had a hamstring pull. So he came out, and Carson Hall did a really nice job for Loyola. I think he won 5 of 6 in the first quarter, and you could tell that Loyola started to feed off of that energy. They were really active with their sticks and passing lanes, caused a lot of turnovers, and the offense was super efficient. But I just had this lingering sense of, can they go toe-to-toe for 60 minutes? And ultimately, Colletti started to impose his will. I think he won 7 of 8 in the second quarter. That's when the game flipped. Army scored 4 goals in 75 seconds to turn a 7-5 deficit into a 9-5 lead. What was impressive, well, so 2 things were impressive, one on either side. The first is that Colletti went down after the last faceoff in the second quarter, apparently re-aggravating his hamstring injury. Came back out for the first faceoff in the third quarter, and I asked Reese Berrick postgame. I was like, how much energy and how much juice did that give the boys just to know that, you know, they didn't see this soft tissue injury that had already been a problem, you know, get re-aggravated, and that can be the type of thing where you're just like, oh, man. And not only that, but also, you know, you see your body go down, it has to hurt a little bit. But then also for Loyola to get it back to tied at 10-10 was really impressive. You chirped Loyola for going into a zone. Well, I got some news for you, Bucko. Army played zone 2. So, yeah.
You think I'm going to criticize the troops there? You must not know what kind of patriot I am.
Yeah, you know what else is a zone? The missile defense system. I don't know. Loyola had been playing zone against Army's second midfield. And they decided that it was effective and that Luke Stout, their goalie, was playing really well, that they wanted to use it against the first midfield as well. And they did throughout, you know, basically that midpoint of the third quarter on. But the first possession, they found Gunnar Fellows alone on the backside because Ryan Sposito dragged the guy too high up top for an easy throwback. And Charlie Toomey said postgame, like, that was the mistake, right? Like, they lost by 2, but that was the pivotal goal in the game. And he was disappointed because it was a mistake. They, you know, you got to know that 90 is the shooter that you don't move off of. You want 7 to get to that position and take that shot in this, you know, on a comparative basis, in the sense that, you know, it's not a dangerous shot. He's at 15. You know, the goalie has plenty of time to be able to see where he's going to go. And so he was disappointed in that. But I think it also was a reflection of the fact that, you know, they own the loss, right? They can be disappointed with how they've played, not only in this loss, but also, you know, on the bulk of the season. But at the same time, like, now they kind of know. Yeah, I don't want to say they know who they are. But you know, we had talked about Loyola when they were in kind of that, like, really rough stretch in the middle part of the year, that they weren't really grasping their identity. I feel like they figured that out. I feel like they understand who they are from a transition offense standpoint. You know, they can make plays. They can rely on their goalie from a defensive standpoint. You know, regardless of when they lose next, and they probably will, it's unlikely that they're going to win the national championship. But I think that the likelihood is higher relative to the early part of the season that they will have lost because they just weren't as good as their opponent, and they will have played okay. They might even have played well. They just won't have played well enough relative to what were they doing? What were they trying to do? You know, which we've already talked about some teams on this podcast, you know, that's what they suffer from. And at this point in the season, if you're a fan, it's way more frustrating to lose that way than it is to lose just because you're not quite as good.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, look at the effectiveness of, you know, Army zone. Ask Germany how effective the Army zone is in France. So, God, there were so many good ones. I was just kind of, I almost went with Midway there, but I was like, that would have been bad. That would have been Navy. So,
ooh, wow, look at you.
Yep, can't do that. You can't get the Army-Navy mix-up, especially that's what you come to the tailgate for, is historical references in relation to lacrosse. No, Patriot League was awesome. I'm excited to watch that conference tournament. And it was so exciting, and it was so fun talking about it, that let's just go ahead and cool off a little bit. And let's go back to really boring snooze fests. We talked about the snooze fest of the Ivy League, but the potential even bigger snooze fest, this was Knapp City, the Big Ten. Michigan won 15-9. Penn State beat Rutgers 14-8. Michigan beat Ohio State. So no close games, no fun.
No upsets.
And no upsets. And it's now Hopkins, Michigan, and Maryland versus Penn State. And hopefully someone does something cool and something happens to make up for what they just did this past weekend.
You're right.
Cool. Hopefully, moving on.
Hopefully that happens.
A-10, more like the A-10 out of 10. Thank you. St. Joe's won 10-9 and secured the top seed in the conference. And St. Joe has kind of flown under the radar. We haven't talked about him much, but I love this team. Not only because my former intern, Kulin Reich, is on there. And he's also a fitness guy on Instagram right now.
Are we okay with that?
A diet guy, where he's like, here's what I eat in a day. It's like beef, and it's always beef, eggs, cheese, and like an avocado. I'm okay with whatever he does. Go do, you do you. And I hope he...
I don't know if the Cloud Police were going to get involved at all with
not right
being,
now because
being
he's
an Instagram
a good kid.
Thought.
Yeah,
understood.
Not fitness, nutrition influencer. And I hope this is one of those cases where I'm like, dude, what are you doing? Like, and then it blows up, and now all of a sudden he has like sponsors. That's happened a couple times where I'm like, what are you guys doing? Like, grow up. Oh, nice. Congrats on the success. But St. Joe's, just talking about them as a team. I mean, they play shit show ball. I mean, yeah. It's heavy riding, Canadians doing Canadian stuff all over the field. They're pushing transition. They don't really care. They play, you know, their team writes checks that their egos and bodies sometimes can cash, sometimes can't. But it's going to be entertaining all day long. They're dice rollers, and they let it ride. And so with their victory, they are going to host UMass, and then Richmond is going to take on High Point to go into the conference semis. So,
well, they don't host UMass because they play at UMass because that was a predetermined site, but they are the number one seed playing the number four seed Minutemen, who lost to High Point on Friday. I believe the final was 17-10.
Yeah, and that's always a bummer where it's like, nice, we're going to host at their field. Super
correct.
Sick.
So. Correct. Yeah, no, man. Okay, so if you remember after the Richmond-Virginia game, which is to say the Virginia-Richmond game, not like the Richmond, Virginia, game, implying that that is the state that the city of Richmond is in. I said that I watched that game extra intently in order to come away with a why is this team good understanding, and specifically beyond Dalton Young is really good and Zach Vigu is really good and they have some other good pieces, but generally speaking, like that's why they're I like, who are they, like what's their deal, what's their essence, whatever. And like I struggled, and then I had a similar experience watching it against Georgetown. And ultimately what it comes down to is, you know, when I watch this team, I struggle to like just really get it. I it sounds ridiculous, and I don't even like the way it sounds coming out of my mouth, but it's also the way that I felt coming away from this game yesterday, right? And I don't really have that feeling when I watch St. Joe's. You know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, they were the new team on the block, and they were super exciting. They were playing a style that's very similar to the way that they were playing now. And you would watch their game, and you'd just be like, yeah, I mean, you know, if you remember that first-round tournament game against Yale that I think was 18-17, and they had three long pole goals, including a couple off the wings of faceoffs. It was like, you know, they play... they play like Loyola Marymount basketball in the early 90s, right? In the sense that, you know, it is so distinctive that you say something like that and two generations later, people still know what you're referring to. And so this was a contrast of styles in that way. But at the same time, it was so, so similar because these teams are right next to each other in the rankings. Despite the fact that Richmond was on a 10-game win streak and I'm sorry, St. Joe's was and Richmond was not because they had played and lost to Georgetown in the middle of the season, they still had roughly similar profiles in terms of the quality of their wins, the quality of their losses, how few bad losses they had, etc. And so everything about this like forecasted it to be a really close game. And then So Levi Virch makes this play at the end of the second quarter where he picks up a ball. Christian Sweezy made a big deal out of this in their game write-up, and the horn blows for a shot clock violation. But he didn't stop. And so because there was time running down in the second quarter, and he threw the ball ahead and they scored, and then they proceeded to score, I think, the first three goals in the second quarter and turn what I think either was a one goal or a tied game into either a 4 or 5 goal lead. And that's what ended up being the difference, because Richmond made this run late in order to get it to one, and then Dalton Young had an opportunity to tie the game coming off of an end line restart with about 5 seconds to go that ultimately got saved. And so, yeah, I mean, the point is that it does appear that there's pretty significant stratification in the A-10. It appears that Richmond and St. Joe's are cut above High Point and UMass, who are a cut above Hobart and St. Bonaventure. But we'll see, right? Because these semifinals are Upset City. And, you know, we've seen it in the past. And so, you know, we'll just see how it shakes out. But very, very compelling game that, again, I came away from a little bit at a loss for exactly how to describe what I saw out of the Spiders.
And, you know, again, there's the Richmond is a team that kind of has me scratching my head. How can you play Virginia that close and then not, you know, at least be as good as you were in that game moving forward? So, but, you know, Terry, it's why you play the game. It's why, for sure. It's why you play the game. Moving on, we have three more conferences. We'll go with the CAA. Towson beat Delaware. And this is one of those matchups that I don't even think I realize how much these two teams hate each other. It's just, it gets chippy. They really don't like each other. And the reason why I don't is I'm like, why would Towson hate Delaware? Like, what's the beef there? Turns out there's, you know, years of rivalry and, you know, all this beef and stuff like that. So might have to tune in to Towson, Delaware on a more frequent basis. But Bodie Muir scored with 1:31 left in the game for Towson to clinch the number one seed. But the field is set. Towson is going to be hosting Drexel, and Delaware is going to be taking on Fairfield in the CAA. And to your point, it kind of seemed to me like in the same way that Richmond and St. Joe's are a little bit of a cut above the next two, it appears to me like Towson and Delaware are a cut above Fairfield and Drexel. But is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. But I do want to shout out Fairfield because they had a very sneaky season insofar as they got out to an 0-3 start. You know, I remember saying, I think I said it on this podcast, but, you know, I thought that they were going to play Carolina tough. That was a neutral site game. I don't even think there was a stream for it, so I don't know that anybody got it, you know, got an opportunity to see it if you weren't there in person. And Carolina ended up winning 19-8, and I was like, oh, okay, well, I take it back. And then, you know, they were 4-5 after losing to Towson in, I guess it was their second CAA game on March 23rd. And since then, they're 4-1, and far and away, the most important win was an 11-10 win over Stony Brook 2 weeks ago that eventually, you know, essentially ended up putting them in this position where, you know, not only were they in the CAA tournament, but they're in the CAA tournament as the 3 seed, you know, 5-2 overall in the league with only that second loss to Delaware being the other blemish. So Andrew Baxter done a great job so far this year, especially because, you know, this is a team that had a couple of really good players decide to enter the transfer portal after last year. And, you know, tremendous credit to guys like Bryce Ford and Wilkins Soley, Jake Gilbert, who, you know, stuck around. And you know, this is a talented team and a team that I think you can kind of invest in going forward in terms of their continued improvement, especially because one of the elements of that disdain for Delaware that I don't think it probably manifests on the field, but it certainly manifests in the adjacent boardrooms on campus is, you know, Delaware is leaving the CAA in all sports as part of a move to take a step up in football, and their future from a men's lacrosse standpoint, as far as I know, is still undecided. So typically never really looked, you know, kind of well upon whenever you have a move like that. We saw it with James Madison a couple years ago, and you know, another kind of log on the fire as far as the rivalry is concerned between Delaware and its CAA foes, but also potentially if they end up outside of the CAA and men's lacrosse, you know, just another opportunity for Fairfield to take a step closer to the top of the league.
Yeah, and I'll give a shout out to Jake Hervada, coach at Delaware, active on Twitter. Him and I go back and forth. He's given me some good insight, you know, the past couple of years, actually. So good guy. Congratulations. And I always put Delaware sneaky as like the, hey, if you're going to go, you know, middle of the pack, D1, I haven't met a blue hen that I haven't thoroughly enjoyed. Shout out Connor Frazina. Shout out John Grant Jr. Shout out Curtis Dixon. Shout out Jay Cravata. Shout out Owen Grant. All great people. Alumni base, sneaky, very fun there. And that's the analysis that you come here for on the tailgate.
I thought they came here for military analogies.
We're just a sampler platter. You get a little mozzarella stick, you get a little nacho, you get a little onion ring, and then we all go to bed fat and happy. The ASUN, interesting conference this year. So the stage is set. Robert Morris is going to play Jacksonville. Bellarmine is going to play Cleveland State, who makes the conference tourney in the playoffs for the first time in program history. Shout out to them. No longer, you know, are they just the bye week for everybody. They are slowly making their way and finding their path forward. The winners of those games are respectively going to take on Utah and Air Force in Colorado Springs at Elevation. And the potential, I mean, there was a snowstorm in Denver a couple days ago. So,
well, there was a lightning storm. There was 184 lightning strikes on Friday night. It set a record. I don't know who tracks that record. I don't know what the record was. But I did see the Denver Twitter account post that there was a record set for lightning strikes. I was like, oh my God.
What is it? Just a guy going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And they have technology that tracks that a little bit better. But yeah, I'm sure that's exactly what it was.
No, it's just a bunch of guys counting in a field.
Wait, did you get that one?
What?
No, that's what happens when you don't know whether or not you can't, whether one guy got the lightning strike and the other one.
Oh.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, anyways, moving on. I missed that. It was my 17th flight of April this morning. So give me a break here. ASUN predictions and takes, Terry.
Yeah, congrats to Andy German. I'm obviously from Cleveland, so...
Allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah. I mean, I'm actually not from Cleveland. I'm from Westlake, Ohio, which is not Cleveland. Very close, though, in the same way that you are not from Denver. Yeah, I went to their first game in program history in 2017, and... To the point that you made, the sneaky part is that in 2019, they were the 35th best team in college lacrosse. The problem was that they were independent. And so Dylan Sheridan leaves, you know, joins Nick Meyer's staff at Ohio State, was there for the COVID-shortened season, then became the head coach at his alma mater at Western Reserve. And now, you know, basically they kind of suffered from, you've seen this happen over the course of the last decade, that, you know, startup programs, that their best season is their fourth season, and then they have to, you know, take a step or two back because they graduate such a large class, you know, a class of guys that took a risk on a program that didn't exist. So they have, you know, this extra motivation, this extra belief, this extra whatever, this je ne sais quoi, that typically, you know, helps to take the program to new heights. So they, number one, lost their coach. Number two, lost that season due to COVID. And then they entered the ASUN, which is at the time the biggest conference in college lacrosse, at the time that they were kind of like building back from both of those things, right? Having graduated that inaugural class and also having gone through a coaching change. So missed the ASUN tournament in 2022 and 23, and then have an opportunity to take on the Detroit Titans in a winner gets to go to the conference tournament opportunity. The challenge there being that, as we talked about last week, I think, or no, at that point we hadn't reported it yet, Chris Cullen, the head coach of Detroit Mercy, had told the team heading into their game against Bellarmine that he was going to be stepping down after the season. His team responded with a very spirited effort in order to beat the Knights, a very injured Knights team, and got a victory that put him in a position where all they had to do was beat Cleveland State at home in order to take that spot in the conference tournament that ultimately the Vikings ended up securing. So, you know, one of those elements that's even more impressive in terms of for Cleveland State to win that game, because they were going up against a team that had a lot of motivation to send their coach out on a high note. So really nice performance there. And now, they take on a Bellarmine team who, yeah, has taken it on the chin a little bit the last 2 weeks and is flying from Jacksonville to Colorado Springs. They booked that flight in the fall, which I love. As soon as the schedule came out and they were like, all right, we're confident we're going to be a top 16. We might as well book our flight to go straight from Jacksonville to the conference tournament in October or whatever. And they did that. So, you know, they're going to be, depending on how far the Knights go, they're going to be well acclimated to that elevation that you referred to.
And little shout out to Cleveland. City that gets a little dog piled on every now and again. The historical references, the water routes. Yeah. Oh,
I've never heard that.
Yeah.
Well, what do the people say?
That it's a brown, dirty crap hole.
No, not Cleveland. Are you thinking of Detroit?
No. Cleveland gets dogged on. No. And I'm not standing for it anymore. Major part of the Underground Railroad, too, I was reading about earlier. So shout out Cleveland. As we move on to the last conference that we'll be talking about, the MAC.
MACtion.
MACtion, baby. Manhattan and Siena won the quarters, and I'm going to put my hand up here, Terry. I don't have a whole lot of analysis to provide here. My time ran out, and I looked up scores. I'm going to lean on you here. What do you got for me?
Well, no, I mean, I think, what I've got is there's always something exciting about these games whenever they happen, right? And, you know, it doesn't matter who the matchups are. It doesn't matter what the stage of the tournament is. So in Manhattan beating Quinnipiac, you had a comeback. And then in Siena beating Marist, you had a team beating a team that they hadn't beaten in like 9 times. So that's what I've got. You know, these are two really good teams. Do we know whether our friend Jules Henningberg is going to be on the call? He has been this conference championship game the last few years. So we've got Siena against Sacred Heart on Thursday. Sacred Heart, by the way, just an absolutely unbelievable season. Kind of an out of nowhere campaign. 11-4, they have won what looks like 9 games in a row, which is definitely the longest streak in college lacrosse. So really impressive job by John Basti's group there. And then on the other side of the bracket, we've got the Jaspers taking on LIU. So, again, another team where, you know, coaching changed 2 years ago. We have had Eric Wolf on this podcast. He did a really good job building up that program, like the NJIT job. And now Jordan Levine has come in after, I believe he took Mercy to the Division II National Championship game. And in 2 years has them, you know, pretty much back atop the heap. So all I can say is tune into these because they're inevitably going to be one goal games and probably going to see at least one buzzer beater. But it's going to be awesome.
I have a question for you. Who do you think is a better broadcaster, me or Jules?
You.
Oh, clip it. I'm sending it to him. I'm texting him.
I did tell him after his first show that I thought he did a really nice job. That was like 5 years ago, so he might not remember.
That's weird. I don't think I got one of those. But anyways.
I'm sure I didn't watch it.
More on like a broader sense, my favorite games late in the year are kind of like the sneaky outside of your conference games, like Notre Dame Cornell being the example.
Oh, yeah.
I kind of want to see like a couple more of those a year where it's like, hey, so you play early in the year and you kind of, okay, what conferences are beating what conferences? And then you get into your conference play and I'm like, teams have grown and evolved so much that before the conference tournament, I would love to see some coaches, you know, a Maryland, Virginia, maybe, you know, like whatever it might be. Yale, help me out here.
I don't know, Quinnipiac? But hold on, let me jump in because you're going to love this. And you said something that I'm going to push back on. You said before the conference tournament. I disagree. So one of the things that I have so much disdain for is how early the season has moved. And I wrote an article in 2016 illustrating all the factors about why and all the reasons that I was so against it. And I laid out what I think is like a relatively clear plan that, yes, will require some additional costs from the standpoint of housing students on campus after school ends in some places, not all. But you see it happen in baseball and softball and track. So if those sports can do it, why can't lacrosse? You see swimmers and wrestlers housed over Christmas break in ways that spring sport athletes are not. So whatever. I think two things. The first is that Selection Sunday should be moved back 2 weeks to what is now currently the quarterfinals, the quarterfinal weekend. I think that is, I think that the conference tournaments should be the same weekend as what is now the first round of the NCAA tournament. And then that quarterfinal weekend, that is also Selection Sunday, should be your non-conference rival, your local rival. And I actually took, like, all at the time, and this is, I don't know, like I said, 6 years ago or 7 years ago, I went through and, like, divided up all the teams, and I was like, these are the matchups. Like, this is who should play each other. These are the 34 games or whatever that we should get in order to, you know, best facilitate this. And the primary reason is because if you – so I remember there was 1 year where Canisius played their last game of the regular season on April 23rd, and then they didn't make their tournament, and for whatever reason, you know, whatever – I looked at the weather on each of the, like, every game they played. They played three games when the starting temperature was over 32 degrees.
Oh,
and it was just
God.
Like, that sucks. And, like, there's no reason for it. But one of the things that compounds it is that when the conference tournament is the last week of the regular season, that means that everybody doesn't qualify for the conference tournament. Their season is over before that. If you add one regular season game after the conference tournament, then you get to practice, like, You have a 2 week window in order to play prepare for that last game. So at least everybody gets the additional week of practice, because it's kind of a disadvantage on, like, a multi year basis. Like, I think about it all the time in high school sports. When you go deep into the tournament, like, you get additional weeks of practice that then compound over the course of years. And so now if you're lopping off a week or two of practice, you know, for these teams that aren't qualifying for their conference tournament, like, that has a compounding effect on a year-over-year basis, in addition to the fact that it's a spring sport and you should be able to play into May. Everybody should get an opportunity to play a game in May. I don't know. There's like 30 teams that are already done. It's April 28th as we record this. So that's a pet issue of mine. You're not going to have to sell me on the idea that everybody should have a local non-conference rival that they play the last week of the season.
It's comical. How much more intelligent and smarter you are than me. Because I have these half-baked, dumbass thoughts of, like, wouldn't it be cool if there was another cross-conference game to play? And you're like, oh, actually in 2016, let me lay out your stupid thought in a much more eloquent way. I got fired up hearing you describe that. And I'm going to take what you just said, I'm going to pretend like it's my own opinion,
perfect.
And then I'm going to say it verbatim to anybody with an earshot.
Put it in the Merrimack parents group and see what they all have to say about it.
Nope. I am not going to do anything in that group.
That'll do it.
That'll do it. And then we'll end how we started. I mean, what a time of year. Right after this, I'm going to go shower and get the airplane stank off of me. And then I'm getting my little digging tool and I'm going to the front lawn. And I'm going to get those dandelions out. I'm going to get the sprinkler system dialed in. I mean, it's just that time of year. Final note, Dom got me a fly fishing rod.
Okay.
I don't really know how to do it. So her and I went to Cabela's for a fly casting class. Just for fun, you know, dust it off. I did it a couple times as kids. If you want to see me and if you want to hear from me this summer, you're just going to have to come and go fly fishing with me. I'm going to make it my personality. I changed my name in my college group to Fly Fishing Guide, and I'm going to be forcing this issue in on almost every conversation we have moving forward.
I can't wait to see you actually, like, sew your own flies. Like, that's
why
be...
tying class is on the even weekends at Cabela's. I'm going to that one this Thursday.
It is. Oh, did you string your own sticks?
I've never strung my own stick.
Yeah, so that's where, like, the whole art and craft side of the fly fishing thing is going to be an interesting thing. Like, I can imagine you, like, getting meatheadish and be like, I can cast 70 yards! And, like, you know, whatever. But meanwhile, like, you've got, you know, the nerd over in the corner, the Ryder Garnsey who strings everybody's sticks or whatever. I don't even know who that was on your team. Who was it? Who was the stick stringer on your team?
It was Ryder in the pros. Here's how dumb I am. My game stick for 2 years was an extra that I found on the floor of the locker room that nobody claimed. And then Coach Corrigan brought in this company called Stylin Strings. And
yes.
They were like, we're gonna string up all your sticks. And I was like, okay. And then they asked me what I like, and I just didn't know. So if you look at 2013 and 2014, I am using like a teal old head. Didn't know what head it was. Like, I consistently say My game stick for the Mammoth and the Outlaws one year was Brent Adams' stick that he was using to push snow off of his windshield. The level of success that I had in lacrosse was in spite of my lack of understanding of what a lacrosse stick actually is and how it operates. So I am the last person. I've never strung a stick myself. I always just would say, hey, either a 30 rack or a Chipotle burrito, your choice. And so I have a feeling, yeah, I'm going to get very frustrated at the fly tying class this Thursday.
Yeah, and then you're just going to ask somebody, would you prefer a 30 rack or a Chipotle burrito? What is the conversion rate of flies to a lacrosse stick head? Like, I don't know how difficult it is to tie a fly relative to string up a head.
I think four or five good ones per burrito. And then what's nice too is, you know, I'm just going to walk in there like a big dumb idiot and go, you can have a 30 rack, a Chipotle burrito, or you can get a wedgie if you don't agree to either one of these two. So
maybe your boy from the trail that gave you the ticket for walking your dog off leash, maybe he's into fly fishing and you can get him to string up some ties.
Yeah, no, he reached out to me and he's still waiting on a response. Brian. Oh, what a great episode, Terry. What a fun time.
Couldn't have been better. Love you more, Nick.